Today we're going through the next four chapters, chapters 9 and 12. So this is a bit of a task to see, as like we said before, to see about condensing all this into some sensible, coherent type of insightful account of how Krishnamurti looks at consciousness, and in what way is that indeed, like I said, insightful in terms of our self-understanding and change. And as far as I could tell, the basic themes that he was raising in these four chapters were time and death. The first chapter 9, then he switched to love, and then he went in chapter 11 to basically sensitivity, and then 12 about the observer and the observed. So basically what we have is the question of time and death, love and awareness, perception, attention, which of course, as you know, for Krishnamurti is the linchpin of the whole thing. So chapters basically 11 and 12 are one thing. He just goes more specifically into the whole question of the observer and the observed at the end, which I found quite insightful, quite helpful, because he goes into how the image works. And that could be, so he describes a structure. And that to me is always helpful. I think the mind finds it helpful to see structures. Not that he wants, not that he's comfortable with the structure. Knowing a structure is not the same as seeing it in action. But I think it's helpful because then it helps to focus, yeah, to sharpen your attention that there is a structure, that there's a movement that can be perceived as an actual sequential phenomenon. So that is helpful. And I think that the question of the image and how it works, how the observer is constituted, what is the nature of the self, and why Krishnamurti finds it so important that freedom from the self is at the core of restoring our wholeness, our freedom, our goodness, and opening our own being to the full potential that we described some time earlier. So Miles had wanted to talk about time. So this is one opportunity for us maybe to mention the subject. Although, as you can see, Miles, there are plenty of other things that are coming along the lines. But time certainly is so central to all of this. Krishnamurti says, time is the enemy of man. Now, wait a minute, we have plenty of enemies without it. We are enemies unto ourselves, enemies, we're surrounded by enemies, and sometimes we find ourselves being our own enemies as well, because conflict is what seems to pervade the structure of consciousness as well as the field of relationship. So that is one of the major challenges that we have, and I think that would be, should be, the fundamental concern, therefore, as human beings. What does it mean to live in peace? What, therefore, what lo does love mean? Because where there is conflict, there's no love. That's basically it. And therefore, we state continuously in a state of no love, no freedom, and destruction, mutual self-destruction. But he says at the core of that enmity is of that conflict, of that division, lies time. Now, other weird thing to say. You look at your, you know, time is just an organizing principle. What is time? That's a difficult question. Even physicists have not answered it very well. Philosophers haven't answered it very well. And we may not be able to answer it very well. But he focuses on time psychologically, on the fact that psychologically you were constructed according to memory, that it is the past that is the substance of consciousness, the content of consciousness, but also what consciousness as thought, that's what we're talking about when we talk about consciousness. We had a bit of discussion yesterday about consciousness with a little C or with a big C. This is all little C's all over the place, is consciousness as the movement of thought based on memory. As thought is based on memory, then thought, fundamentally, the core of thought, is also time. And because it is based in the past, it becomes a factor of fragmentation. The past can never really meet the present fully. So he sees in that very simple observation of his, which we all more or less might admit to or agree to accept, at least intellectually, that the ground of thought is memory. That memory without thought, I mean, thought without memory couldn't really operate. I mean, even that is stretching it a bit. We don't know that it is always the case that intrinsically thought is the response of memory, right? Even Bohm was making a distinction between thought and thinking, that thought as the past participle would be indeed the response of the past, but that thinking might have something else involved, a quality of awareness that might liberate it from its total mechanicalness. When we meet an issue, the past will respond. But as perception is there, then you will check whether that past fits or does not fit. Even when we drive, we've been trained habitually to do certain maneuvers. Say you drive a stick shift car. So you do this, then you do that. And you don't think about it. It's just a mechanical process. So that has its own importance, but you always have to be aware of the road. So the awareness of the road and of the dynamics of the traffic has to be there to inform the mechanical operation of thought. Then that mechanicalness will be properly guided. And you will, hopefully, if you're attentive enough, avoid the accident. But as he used to say, when driving, watch out for the other idiot. So you are an idiot, but the other is also there. So we have to watch out for each other, right? You don't know that the other is aware. Isn't that what we do also when we go on the road? We are aware of who's not aware, right? But also you have to check first on yourself, right? You know that that lack of awareness is what makes sure that you will have an accident. And when you see that others are driving erratically, then you avoid them, right? You move to another lane or just whatever. At least that's what I do. So the awareness is all, right? But thought as time is not just the operation of knowledge in the practical field, but is the operation of knowledge in psychology. That psychologically, it is us, that we are that. The Tat Swam, or whatever they say in Indian, that you are that, they refer to you are sort of the spirit and the highest and the Brahman. But he says, no, what you are is this. What you are is time. What you are is this movement. Now, time, we know it, is divided into past, present, and future. We divide it anyway. The past is always now, because the past is memory. The future is desire. The future is a projection from the past. The only real time is the present. But these two occupy our lives. The past, which looks back on memory and somehow lives that memory as a reality. But it also can project itself into the future and live that as a reality. This is our life. This movement from the past to the present, through the present to the future. Now he says, that's what the consciousness does. It opens a gap. It creates a gap between this moment now and another time that it projects, because it's a projection, or another time that it remembers. See, they used to say, okay, you get up in the morning, then you go and brush your teeth, or shave if you have a beard. And then you start thinking about the lovely time you had in Switzerland. So you're not brushing your teeth. You keep going mechanically because that's how you learned, but you're somewhere else. You remember the past, and then you say, oh, I'm going to meet so-and-so. That would be nice. So you're in the future. This is how you create a gap between the instant now and the future. So time is a gap. Time is the gap that thought projects between the moment now and the future or the past. Now he says, love has no time, is not of thought. We'll see that in a minute. But then, you see, thought is continuity, depends on continuity for its existence, and he meets life with that continuity. Without continuity, without accumulation, thought has no basis. And of course, we need continuity, right? Because that's security. Tomorrow does exist. At least we estimate that it does. Partly because we know it from the physical reality. Time, very basically, physically, could be seen this I only offer as a potential, as a possibility, as my own naive, perhaps, attempt to comprehend what time might be. But you can see, more or less, it's more complicated than that, I'm sure, and the physicists would be able to tell me, you know, much more complex version of what time is. But essentially what it becomes, what it has to come to us, is that we is a measurement of recurrent movement. You can see that. That is, we measure the days, the hours, the weeks, the years, according to a pattern of movement that recurs, that comes back to itself. That is predictable enough that we can rely on its continuity. If the sun and the earth were moving at random, the days and the weeks and the months would go out the window. So there's a regularity and a measurement. How do you know that an hour has 60 minutes? Who came up with that? Well, somebody looked at the sky, they looked at the movement of the thing, they said, well, this is 24 hours, this is how we did it, measurement. I couldn't even begin to reconstruct it myself except by looking at somebody else. So the watch I have in my hand is the result of a very complex way of looking at the world and of measuring that very physical phenomena. I take it for granted that this is now seven something. Okay, yeah and no, right? Is a measure, a number that we give to that recurrence. But therefore, that has become so important. Look at our civilization. It depends so strongly on time in order to organize itself. We are driven by time. We're controlled by time. We're the slaves of time. But it's a time that we have ourselves created through this measurement as a means to organize physical reality and achieve certain things as a process, right? Because we count on tomorrow, the sun rising and setting, and therefore we have time. We have time. We give ourselves time. But Kay says, careful. There is a space, or he suggests, or he questions time within the psychological field. And he says, have we learned anything? Because we say you learn from experience. So he says, have we learned anything from experience? So yes, we have learned a lot. Science is experience. Science is experimentation. Science says this happens because of that. And given these circumstances, it happens all the time. Thank you very much. And then again, shift it a little bit. This is what happens. So that is experience. That's why you have a lab. A lab is a field of experience. It's experimentation where it happens. We have that too in the whole thing. But he says we have not learned after thousands of years of war to stop it. So the learning of experience seems to apply to a particular field, but not to another. That psychologically, experience has not taught us to end the structure of conflict. We have not learned to stop war because we have not learned about ourselves. We have not learned what time is doing psychologically because it's also time, psychological time. Psychological time is the same as physical time. It's just memory, right? It's just memory. But it's a memory that constitutes itself into an entity that separates itself from other things and feels itself to be apart. That is that real? You see, that's why he says he questions the actuality of this structure. So time becomes the enemy because in his view, is undermining our own integrity, is at the source of conflict and is what is destructive in our lives. Is that correct? That's a major thing to say about time, psychologically, because time is me. Take it logically and you say, well, then I am my enemy. The enemy is me. And that's a tremendous thing to say, because the enemies are always other people, right? Like Sartre said, hell is other people. Hell is other people. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You look a little closer in the mirror of relationship, and you'll see that you, psychologically, the psychological entity is the factor of division, because it's stuck to a past which is not meeting the present and is always looking out to his own interests. He's manipulating the reality. The other is an object for it, and he wants to achieve, he wants to succeed, he wants to have pleasure, desire. The whole movement of that biological conditioning, really, of thought and the self as becoming. Time is becoming for us. So time is not only the organization of the physical environment, but the achievement of something for yourself is the track that the self takes to become. That's why it's become even more important than chronological time. Right? But he says, but there, as long as you live in time, you live in fear. What? He's destroying my little ladder of success. He's destroying my little road of achievement. I'm going to become somebody, for the love of God, to leave me alone. And the old boy said, no, you're not becoming anything. You're just a little creature pretending that time will help it to be. But look at it. It doesn't even help you to change. It doesn't help you to end your sorrow, your misery, your violence, because all that is the product of time. Time, therefore, is not the answer to our problems, because it is the problem. All psychological problems are derived from the fragmentary nature of thought, time, and self. That's the enemy. Meet the enemy, and which means meet yourself. Meet the enemy. This is what Krishnamurti's teachings are inviting us to do. Nobody wants to meet the enemy. Everyone wants to run away, and that's why maybe he says we're always running away from ourselves, because we realize how dangerous the whole... We don't want to realize, rather, how dangerous the whole thing is. This is his diagnosis, right? But he also, time is this gap we have created between birth and death. So there is this gap somehow between when we were born, this moment now also, and the moment of death. I still recall when I was about 5 years old or 6 years old, and for the first time, I realized that I was going to die. I wonder sometimes, was I immortal before then? At least psychologically, I had no sense of my own death. It's extraordinary that it was a time in my life when I didn't know about death, wasn't conscious, aware that, and at that moment, very shocking. It paralyzed me completely. I'm going to die. I was just playing around like any village kid. And suddenly, under this blue sky, there is death. The realization that I'm going to die. One day, this is no more. The sky will be just as blue. The summer just as warm and the ground just as dry. And I will not be there. Whoa, tremor. And that tremor hasn't left me really. It's there every day, no? We're going to die, all of us. Everybody. And look what we're making of life. Such a struggle, right? We struggle from birth to death, and it's all going to end. But we're all so invested in continuity that we don't want to even think about it. Death is another enemy. We don't realize that the enemy is us. And that death for Krishnamurti is not an enemy. For Krishnamurti, death is a friend, is a liberator. Not in the physical sense, that will happen. But that psychologically is a necessity, is actually a factor of freedom. Because it means the ending of the whole structure of continuity of time and self that is at the source of our fragmentation. So death, psychologically, is the means, it's not the means, it means wholeness. Means, therefore, life in its fullness. And that is an interesting thing for me, because when you think about it, we realize that one of the main struggles, pervasive fears, and factors of fragmentation that exist in life is that separation between life and death. Because as long as they're separate, we are condemned indeed to live in fear. I don't know if you ever met the fear of death. It's very interesting. I mean, it happened only to me once, but it's very interesting. So I share that with you if you don't mind. which was, I wanted to write a book about Krishnamurti. And I put a lot of self-importance into it. So I was really keen on that, you know. Everybody, we all think that the justification and meaning of our life is in achieving something. So look what I was trying to achieve. So then I got very ill, fortunately, I think. Very ill, and I feared to die. And therefore, my achievements were completely gone down the drain. I wasn't going to write any book, and I wasn't going to publish anything. Nothing. And that was interesting. I was completely seized by this panic fear for days. But it was interesting because I didn't escape from it. I didn't do anything else. And at a certain moment, I was just sitting at my desk, and this fear of death just came. It was there. Total. See, we never let anything be total. This was total. It started in the pit of my stomach and arose like a dark cloud that was engulfing my whole being. Luckily, at that same moment, a ray of light went down into it, penetrated the shadow, and went to the source of it. The source of it was nothing. What we're afraid of is the nothingness that we know is at the foundation of our own being. As far as I'm concerned, that was an insight, and the fear just went. And I never worried about whether I would write a book or not write a book. I might still write a book, but there's no self-investment in it. But you see, that's why my sense is that consciousness based on time is bound to fear and is bound to escape from this nothingness that underlies the very movement of thought. And thought knows it. It must be aware of that nothingness in order to escape from it. And yet it does, because it threatens the grand edifice of the me as becoming. To me, that's the foundation of fear. And death is the ending of that movement of escape from the emptiness that underlies our being. That's at the core of our being. Our being has to do with that emptiness. And that's the emptiness of consciousness too. So there is no distinction, therefore, between you and the universe. It's all the foundation is of creation is in nothingness. And that has to be a discovery. And only then does fear end. Otherwise, there will be always this struggle between the movement of thought as becoming and the emptiness of death, which is life. We don't live as long as we are focused on the future. We don't live if that focus is on the past. And cultures are also like this. They're rooted in the past and look into the future from that narrow perspective, conditioned by that background. And we are like that too. That's time and death, how necessary it is, therefore, to comprehend the dimension of ending of that which is false. And this is a false movement. It's real and true in the physical environment, and it's false psychologically. That's an important thing to consider. I mean, it's easy to say that it's false. Hey, wait a minute, we're still in it. Let's not take any authority for it for granted, anybody's words for it. But therefore, if death is separate, as I said, this is another aspect of time. For us, time is just the gap between beginning and end. But the end and the beginning in living are simultaneous. The comprehension of that is very important in terms of freeing ourselves from this burden of the past as the movement of becoming. This is essential. For Kay, he would see this as the essence of the essential mistake that mankind has made. This is another diagnosis. If you read the ending of time, the dialogues between Kay and Bohm, you see the ending of time is the same as freedom from the known. Because what he's talking about, can the known end? Can we be free from the past in such a total way that we function from another place, not from the space of fragmentation, which is what breaks down life, divides and creates conflict and brings about sorrow, but from this emptiness, which is immediate perception without distortion. That's why he has to look into the question of the observer and the observed as being the factor of distortion in perception, and therefore the breakdown of the wholeness of our lives and the alienation of love. when there is fragmentation and conflict, there's no love, and this is the source. So when he looks at love, he says that to love, you must die. I found that very, I mean, if you just read the phrase like that without context, you say, this guy is bananas, no? To love is to die. I think he has some phrase like that in one of his chapters, no? To love is to die. Why? I think because of this, right? That if you don't die, we don't die, the consciousness doesn't die to its fragmentary, its fragmentation, to its identification with the past, the creation of this entity of time, it will continue to divide and break down and create conflict. We may say any number of times that we love. I love my country, I love my flag, my God, and everything else. That's what he was saying there in one chapter, no? All right, you love your God, yes? Good. But what's your God? Your projection. So you're loving yourself. Is that love? You do that every day. Anyway, you only love yourself. And if you only love yourself, that's not love. It's not, I suppose it would be called narcissism. So our psychology is very narcissistic. You just have an image you project and then you fall in love with it. And you say, I love that. My God is better than yours. That's how we go. You see, my identity is better than yours. Everybody's comparing. It's a comparative world. And in love, Kay would say, there's no comparison. There's no measurement. There's no division, right? This is implied. Let's not idealize love. We have to face it as we are. But then he goes into it, you see, also. This is what Kay does. Picks up a subject. You can see the relationship between time, death, love. So they have a connection. There is a dialectic internally, psychologically, between these three themes of thought and time, creating this division, this self, which alienates us from ourselves, as a matter of fact, creates a fictional being within the domain of time. And then death, which says, this doesn't hold up, you see, sorry about it, it's finishing anyway, and you should finish, because you live in the past. And if you live in the past, from the past, by the past, and for the past, a very democratic system of the past, by the past, for the past, and by the past, then you are dead. So actually the diagnosis is that let the dead bury the dead, let the past die, let the past operate where it's necessary, and let it rest in peace where it's no longer needed. Whereas no, it actually interferes, becomes its own self-contradiction. The way we mean to love, we create hate. The way we mean to be secure and peaceful, we create war. The way we mean to really, how you say, be creative, we just destroy. So there is that contradiction that mankind has been living with for ages, which Krishnamurti points it is here, lies in this whole dynamic of the relationship between thought and time, its necessary ending, which he calls death, is psychologically all of it, and then the necessity of love, because without it, we will continue to destroy one another. This everybody knows, as a matter of fact. We've known it for ages, that without love, we'll carry on being the old murderers that we've been for generation after generation, and we still are, and happily are doing it for the higher cause. Right? And the collective approval is all justified, is all even legal. Yeah, you just have to take care of how you do it. All right. Now we're crazy. So this is the dialectic. So now love, we all want love. We all want to be loved. We all want, yeah, otherwise, what is it? Some of my friends say, for me, the most important thing is in life is love. And all the songs say that, no. Love, love me do, you know I love you, and all that kind of stuff. They keep going with love. I mean, I at some point I got really tired of these love songs because they were not about love, right? They're about sex. They're really about romantic sensation. No? That's about what it means. So that's a fundamental meaning that we have had for a long time also. It's not just now. It's not since the 60s that the sexual revolution, that love and sex have become one and the same thing. It's been there since the Greeks. They had different distinctions of the nature of love. Love as eros, lovers philos, and lovers agape. They had three or four different kinds of love, right? Fine. The Chinese had maybe even more, because they were much more detailed in their distinctions. But that's why Krishnamurti says, in order to find out what love is, we have to wipe out the slate of what the past, what tradition has said. Let's see if we ourselves can face what we actually do, what we call love, and if what we call love is really love. So he looks at what we actually do and he says, all right, take love as we mean it normally, which is desire, sensation, pleasure, sex. Is that love? Well, when you're in the middle of it, it feels very good indeed. Excitement, passion, pleasure. You feel sort of almost out of yourself. For once, you know, you touch somebody. We're also isolated, starved for affection. So that feels like liberating. Except that it doesn't take long for it to dawn on us that there is a glitch in the whole movement. He develops into it. Some people are good at going through and not caring, right? And just they go one from pleasure to another. They don't care. Fine, happy, liberated people. But normally, the thing involves attachment, therefore possessiveness and dependence, therefore domination, fear of losing, the jealousy that comes with us, and therefore the conflict arises because you are mine and I'm yours, and you just looked at that woman, and she just looked at that man. So there is a problem that arises in this exclusive understanding of the me wanting to secure his own, the continuity of his own pleasures, satisfactions, comforts, and so on. There's something beautiful in that two people commit and say, I'm with you, and I mean to be with you, I care, and voila. It's not like I won't look. I will look, but my commitment is there. And there's no two ways about it. Yeah, but that's not, the anthropologists say, that's not what the monkeys used to do, and that's not what we do as monkeys. So there you are. We have an internal dialectic as to even at that sensuous level, we go about it, right? Love, of course, from the religious point of view, has greater dimensions. And even socially, we say you love your country or you love poetry. We love all kinds of things. Love with an object. Kay wants to bring it. Love of beauty, right? As Kay says, there's no love without beauty. Now that we also thought, even the Greeks had that thing. Love and beauty go together. Plato, in the Symposium. They were talking about it while they drank themselves silly. The only one who could hold his liquor was Socrates. So that's why he was lucid. But there they were discussing love, you see, already 400 BC in a brilliant way, right? And the sense of beauty and love going together. But what is beauty? See, look what we do also. Everything for us is material, is sensory. And so there you are, you value beauty that way, the beauty of form according to the standards of the particular culture in which one has been brought up. So beauty, as they used to say, is in the eye of the beholder. So it is your pattern, already pre-existing pattern, that determines whether something is beautiful or not. And beauty always has an object. So Kay says, wait, there's another beauty. And therefore, there's another love, which has nothing to do with sensation, with form, with pleasure, desire, or any of it. The aesthetics. The aesthetics for him has another dimension. There is beauty without an object. That sounds very Platonic, doesn't it? Okay, I was going to say Bohm, because Bohm always reminds me of Plato. But it was Plato who sort of had this sense of beauty, truth, and goodness are not in an object. They exist by themselves. The objects are just kind of reflections of that primal original forms. He called them forms. Krishnamurti wouldn't call them forms because the form is in the material expression, right? But what does it mean, therefore, to see beauty that has no object? Beauty per se? Have we ever had that sense? beauty per se, love per se, nor love of somebody, nor love of something, nothing, not enough from an image, right? Most, because those are all images, but they're actually perceived objectively as they exist in the mind, or then, you know, imagined from whatever source, memory, or whatever source we drew them from. The image is the form in thought of the physical form, right? So he says it's not a form and it's not an object. What does that mean? Very beautiful suggestion. Huh? When is that take place? And he says that takes place when there is no beholder, when there is no observer. The observer is actually responsible for the identification of the object as a form and beauty as a form from his own preconceived structure. If the self is not, then beauty is. It was always his thing, you know, as an artist, as a something of an artist when I was young, I had an artistic inclination. I could draw quite well. And I was very interested to find out what was art really, because it's just not drawing, it has a meaning in itself, right? Something intrinsic to it, to the artistic endeavor. So I wanted to find out. When I ended up at Brookwood, I expected a definition from Kay about what art was. But Kay didn't give any definition. It was a bit disappointing, because the key to art, as I understood it, at least naively perhaps, was that its beauty is the object of art. Just like truth is the object of science, or goodness is the object of religion. I call them objects in terms of the main direction in which they are, they are directed in that way. Beauty, therefore, look at it. Art, this is what Bohm said also at one point. See, the main occupations of mankind have been with these three. And that's why we have cultivated art, science, and religion as the key approaches to beauty, truth, and goodness. Now, I was onto one thing, was onto beauty as an artist, right? And Kay said, aha, you see, because I already knew from the Greeks, beauty is proportion, right? So therefore, I was trained that way. Well, you had to draw, you see, to go to the Royal Academy, you had to draw from the Greek sculptures, the masters of beauty. They were the ones who they made that definition, that beauty is proportion. So when you drew a Greek sculpture, a Greek, you know, plaster cast, you had to measure so many heads, the height, so many heads, you measured by the head. The head was somehow seven heads or something. It was proportion. They had figured out what was the aesthetically pleasing proportion, for example, for a human body. Eh? Kay says, beauty has nothing to do with measure. Doesn't it? At the same time, just as a detail, and I hope I'm not deviating too much from the subject, he told us nonetheless that when he was young, he ended up visiting Athens. And he was very early up in the Acropolis when there was nobody around, and he fell on his knees before the Parthenon. I say, well, how does this guy, this great guy, with his understanding of beauty, of truth and goodness at the deep mystical level that he reached or that he's been granted to him, go down before this ruin? Well, he saw the greatness of that ruin, the beauty, the goodness, and the truth that was coming through the intelligence. What he talked about mostly was intelligence, that it manifested intelligence of a high level. He didn't agree with measurement, and yet that temple was built in great part on measurement, but it was beyond measure somehow that he felt also was behind it. There was a creative source that had manifested itself behind it. Now that was reassuring to a lover of ancient culture and somebody who had to copy plaster casts, that there was something deep in the whole thing potentially, and even the wise could go down on their knees before that. So Kay nonetheless said, no, but careful, that is there, and you should be exposed to it, and you should appreciate it, but beauty is where the self is not. He didn't define it, Because he says, at that point, you can't even talk about it. What is there is beyond words. So he's talking about a place where beauty is, which with self is not. So it's not within the domain of the known. It's not within the domain of measure. It is still aesthetics because it's a matter of perception. Love and beauty are a matter of perception. The self is the observer. So the observer, when he's there with his past, projecting his own measures onto what is distorting it, not seeing the whole. So his beauty is not pure and total beauty. Gray might even question whether it was beauty. It might be a conditioned version of that beauty. So what is this observer? Why is he always going on about it? He says the observer is the observed. Now, that's one thing also that it puzzles us, because we know our culture has trained us to separate the two, that there is an object and there is someone who sees it. And that seems to be the case, right? I'm not my computer. Well, to a great extent, more and more, the computer seems to be absorbing me. But then I know my lamp, I know my chair, I know the chair. So I'm not these objects. These are objects, they exist independently of me. Interesting. But now watch it. This is the beauty of the man looking at the nature of what the observer is and how the observer is the observed. That would mean that what it takes to be independent is not independent, but is itself. This is what happens. This is the trick, perhaps the trick, no, the subtlety of the operation of the observer. One basic way I understand it is the observer is essentially based on images. Our perception from the mind is an image, from an image. The observer projects his own image, the image of whatever it is, onto the object, and that's what it sees. Does it inwardly to itself, I am this, and he does it to another, they are that. It projects and sees according to his own memory, but it takes it to be an objective perception existing independently of itself. Now, a prejudice is an easy way to see it. I suppose I'm a racist. I don't know that I am. Suppose I'm a racist, or a nationalist or something. I don't like, what is it? Here in the Netherlands, they have a great prejudice against Muslims, against Moroccans. They are the best, they call it. So there they go, you see. And so they say that the moment they see a Moroccan, and I'm sorry to talk about that, I don't have that prejudice, I don't share any of that. They see that. They see what's already in the mind. There are phrases which are ready-made, which come as a reflex response to that whole situation. And that's what we see. So what we see is not them. What we see is us. When we see that, that misperception collapses because we realize that we're deceiving ourselves. The observer is the observed, is his own projection onto another. When that is perceived, the deception is a deception, right? A self-created deception, that the image does create this false impression that what we project exists independently of us. It does not. Nationalism is like this. Religious affiliation is like this. Racial distinctions are like this. They're all projections which become reality because we've separated ourselves from our own projections. The collapse of the self, therefore, that's the self, is this duality. This is the essential duality that we introduce into our world. The collapse of that is freedom from that deception. Therefore, perception is true. Perception is pure. And therefore, when you see accurately without the self, there is beauty and there is love. Voila. And there is death also accompanying us. As he says, death is always beside us. It was not beside us, it's us. We are death because we love. But what about that? Wouldn't that be beautiful? Since death is to love is to die, we're dying. See, there was a mysterious phrase in one of the dialogues with the Socrates, Platonic dialogues, in which Socrates says, the business of the philosopher is to die. Now, I was puzzled by that for a long time, because I was reading Plato. one of my masters. And good old Plato quotes his master Socrates as saying this: the business of the philosopher is to die. Inwardly, to all these past misconceptions, these projections, and these false notions of what knowledge actually means, the notion of self, the notion of identity, the notion of time. The ending of time is therefore the birth of love and beauty. And that is case, I don't know, beautiful proposal for us. Can we die? That's the question. Let's die beautifully. All right.